Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be telling you how Michelangelo depicted St. Paul on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. But first of all, let's join Jill Bevilacqua for the next in her reflections on the Sunday Gospel. That's for this, the 18th Sunday of the year. Her program has an intriguing title. It's called There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, and starts with a reading of this Sunday Gospel. Stay tuned.
When Jesus heard of the death of John the Baptizer, he withdrew by boat to a deserted place by himself. The crowds heard of it and followed him on foot from the towns. When he disembarked and saw the vast throng, his heart was moved with pity, and he cured their sick. As evening drew on, his disciples came to him with the suggestion, "This is a deserted place, and it's already late. Dismiss the crowd so that they may go to the villages and buy some food for themselves." Jesus said to them, "There's no need for them to disperse. Give them something to eat yourselves." "We have nothing here," they replied, "but 5 loaves and a couple of fish." "Bring them here," he said. Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. He took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, looked up to heaven, blessed and broke them, and gave the loaves to the disciples, who in turn gave them to the people. All those present ate their fill. The fragments which remained when gathered up filled 12 baskets. Those who ate were about 5,000, not counting women and children.
Before we even begin to consider the event recounted in today's Gospel, known universally as the feeding of the 5,000, there's something which should give us pause, make us simply stand back and marvel. The crowds, the vast throng, as we've just heard, which followed Jesus on foot from the towns. The 4 evangelists all tell of this, and in fact the miracle which Jesus was to perform is the only one recounted by all 4. It was springtime. John tells us that it was shortly before the Jewish feast of Passover, probably sometime between February and March of the year 29 AD. The apostles had been sent by Jesus previously to proclaim the kingdom of God and to heal, writes Luke. And a scholar comments that this was their first experience of a mission, limited for the time to Galilee.
So they set out and went from village to village, proclaiming the good news and healing everywhere. On their return, the apostles gave him an account of all they had done.
Thus Luke, and Mark writes,
"The apostles rejoined Jesus and told him all they had done and taught. Then he said to them, 'You must come away to some lonely place all by yourselves and rest for a while.' For there were so many coming and going that the apostles had no time even to eat."
The reason for the departure of Jesus and the apostles to a lonely place seems to be chiefly so that they may have a chance to rest and eat without the crowds breathing down their necks. But there is another reason for the choice of the deserted place, and it's explained in the opening words of our Gospel. When Jesus heard, and in brackets follow the words, of the death of John the Baptizer. John the Baptist had been beheaded on Herod's orders after the request made by Salome, daughter of Herodias, for his head on a platter. But then Herod hears reports of another prophet preaching and healing. Writes Luke,
"Herod the Tetrarch had heard about all that was going on, and he was puzzled, because some people were saying that John had risen from the dead, others that Elijah had reappeared, still others that one of the ancient prophets had come back to life. But Herod said, 'John, I beheaded him. So who is this I hear such reports about?' And he was anxious to see him."
This, it seems, is the key phrase. Herod is a slippery fish, but he had not wanted to kill John. In his own way, he'd even admired him, even listened to him. But he was afraid of John's accusations and fearful of his seemingly mysterious power. For Herod has a guilty conscience, and now, from his superstitious fear of John, he passes to a superstitious fear of this new prophet. After they've buried him, John's disciples come to Jesus and tell him all this. Jesus does not fear for himself, but he now acts out of prudence. Writes Piero Bargellini.
A prudence which is not cowardice, but a wise and generous concern to avoid dangers to his disciples and followers from the political authorities, and trouble from the religious ones.
Hence the decision to leave Capernaum, which lay in Herod's territory, and cross over to that of his brother Philip. Where exactly did they go? John writes, to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Luke, to a town called Bethsaida. But John also writes that Jesus climbed the hillside and sat down there with his disciples. And a scholar notes that they reached the top of a hill in the neighbourhood. Writes Bargellini.
If we look at a geographical map of the region, we see that Bethsaida was quite close to Capernaum and could easily be reached by water, just crossing a short arm of the lake. But what was particularly important, an administrative barrier ran between the two towns. Bethsaida was not in Galilee, but in Trachonitis, and that region was subject to Philip the Tetrarch, not Herod the Tetrarch.
So Jesus and his apostles get into the boat, writes Frank Sheed.
They crossed the northern corner of the lake by boat and came to a place with hills sloping to the water a few miles beyond Bethsaida. It was a desert place indeed, but they did not rest a while. The crowds, whose urgency had driven Jesus and the apostles to the last gasp of exhaustion, saw where the boat was going and followed round on foot. It would not have been more than 7 or 8 miles from Capernaum.
And the amazing thing is, as we read, that they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Both Capernaum and Bethsaida have disappeared from the map. Archaeologists believe that the site of Capernaum is marked by a mound of black basalt ruins lying on the eastern bank of the lake. H. V. Morton wrote that within 10 minutes by boat from Capernaum is a little bay which is said to mark the site of Bethsaida. And our traveller comments.
When you know the shape of the Sea of Galilee, this incident becomes very vivid. While the little boat was crossing the 6 or 7 miles of water, a great multitude carrying their sick with them followed him on foot out of the cities. Evidently, the crowds had converged, as usual, on Capernaum. But when they discovered that the master had gone, they looked over the water to discover the direction of his boat. They saw with joy that he was going only to the opposite shore, probably to the little fishing port of Bethsaida Julius at the inlet of the Jordan. This meant that if they lost no time and, racing round the northern end of the lake, waded over the shallow Jordan, they would reach Bethsaida Julius almost as soon as Jesus.
And in fact, as we know, they got there before him, and he would have soon realized this. Incidentally, while Morton gives Bethsaida a second name of Julius, an Italian scholar writes.
Bethsaida is often mentioned in the Gospels. According to John, it was the hometown of Philip, Andrew and Peter. It was a village of fishermen on the north bank of the Sea of Galilee, a little to the east of the point where the River Jordan enters the lake. Philip the Tetrarch transformed the village into a town. It was called Julia, perhaps in honour of the daughter of the Roman Emperor Augustus.
And continuing his account, H. V. Morton writes.
As Jesus crossed the water, he would see this great race of over 5,000 round the north end of the lake, and he would know that whatever thoughts he may have had of praying in a desert place apart, and of meditation on the death of the forerunner, were fated to be given up in service to the crowds. No sooner had he landed than the crowds came to him.
and presumably they followed him relentlessly up the green hill. What the exhausted apostles thought at this point we're not told. Bargellini writes that neither Jesus nor the disciple showed any trace of disappointment. Indeed, Luke says he welcomed them. Matthew, as in our Gospel today, writes, "When he disembarked and saw the vast throng, his heart was moved with pity, and he cured their sick." While Mark tells us that he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Writes Sheed.
Once more the sight of the crowd was too much for Jesus' resolution. Once more the teaching and the healing began and went on steadily through the day. By the end of the afternoon they were still thronged about with people, 5,000 of them, to say nothing of women and children, adds Matthew, who as a tax collector had been accustomed to counting heads.
But it's growing late, and the disciples prudently suggest to Jesus that he send the crowds away to go and buy themselves food in one or other of the neighbouring villages. "There's no need for them to go. Give them something to eat yourselves," is the surprising answer. And here the evangelists give their separate versions of what happened next. Matthew recounts simply, "All we have with us is 5 loaves and 2 fish. Bring them here to me," he said. Mark has the disciples answering, "Are we to go and spend 200 denarii on bread for them to eat?" "How many loaves have you?" he asked. "Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Luke's account is somewhat similar. "We have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we're to go ourselves and buy food for all these people." John's account contains details none of the others mention. Jesus speaks to Philip.
"Where can we buy some bread for these people to eat?" He only said this to test Philip. He himself knew exactly what he was going to do. Philip answered, 200 denarii would only buy enough to give them a small piece each. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said, "There's a small boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what is that between so many?"
Apart from the reference to Philip and Andrew, John is also the only evangelist to describe the loaves as barley loaves, which some commentators have seen as a reference to the miracle in the Old Testament of Elisha during a famine.
"A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God bread from the first fruits, 20 barley loaves and fresh grain in the ear. 'Give it to the people to eat,' Elisha said. But his servant replied, 'How can I serve this to 100 men? "Give it to the people to eat," he insisted, "for Yahweh says this, they will eat and have some left over." He served them, they ate, and had some left over, as Yahweh had said.
And finally, a scholar reminds us that barley bread was the usual food of the poor. H.V. Morton writes that commentators have imagined that the boy with the loaves and fishes was one of the bread boys still to be seen in Arab towns, sometimes with strips of dried fish, which they sell with the bread. And he goes on.
There's one point in St. John's Gospel of the miracle which is extremely interesting. In describing the fish eaten on this occasion, he uses the Greek word opsarion, which our translators render as small fish. St. John is the only evangelist to use this word, and the real meaning is not small fish, but a savoury dish, or as we might say, hors d'oeuvres. This is exactly what the small pickled fish of Galilee were in the time of Christ.
This is a wonderful instance of the vivid local colour which has been detected in the fourth gospel, because no one unacquainted with the life and speech of Galilee could have employed this word. And as we know, the fish was used as a symbol of Christ by the early Christians, on account of the fish mentioned in this miracle. Moreover, the letters of the Greek word for fish, ichthus, formed an acronym of the initial letters of the words Jesus Christ, Son of God, Saviour. Mark too, writes Sheed, giving us Peter's memory of the great day makes the scene most vivid. And we come to the moment when our Lord tells the apostles, in Mark's words, to get all the people together in groups on the green grass. And John writes there was plenty of grass there. But Sheed goes on.
It is Peter who remembers that the grass was of the light green colour of spring, and that the groups sitting in their many-coloured robes looked like beds of flowers. But you have to go to the Greek to find that.
Who would have thought that Peter was such a poet? Or was it Mark? And talking of the grass, a scholar confirms that it was springtime.
The mention of the green grass gives us to understand that the incident took place in the spring, when the rainy season was hardly over. In the summer, it hardly ever rains and everything is burnt up by the sun.
Another detail which scholars point out to us is the reference, not mentioned by Matthew or John, to the numbers of the groups. In Luke we read that Jesus said, "Get them to sit down in parties of about 50," while Mark writes, "Then he commanded them all to sit down by companies upon the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties." The reference to 5,000 men, mentioned by all four evangelists, seems, writes the scholar, to allude to the traditions of the Exodus, where the people are presented as a group of almost military discipline and order. But as for the specific numbers of the groups, he writes,
"The texts which reproduce the rule of the Qumran community testify that in the time of Jesus it was thought that at the end of time the community would be reconstructed by God according to that model of Israel in the desert."
And so this marvellous, miraculous picnic began. He gave thanks. Eucharisted is John's word, we read. Blessed and broke the loaves, shared out the fish. All those present ate their fill. The fragments which remained when gathered up filled 12 baskets. A scholar again.
The manner of telling the story of the miracle emphasizes its significance. Jesus, with his word and with the gift of his bread, is the food of his people on their journey through the desert.
And Sheed reminds us.
When St. John tells us that the first teaching on the Blessed Eucharist was so soon to follow, we see a reason why Jesus should have wanted to work this particular miracle at this precise moment.
And we're told that some of the terms John uses in his account are present in the oldest liturgical texts of the Church, such as the Didache. The Greek word synagein, to gather, gave origin to the term synaxis, which indicates the gathering together of the Christian community for the Eucharist. The Greek klasmata, pieces left over, indicated the broken bread, symbol of the scattered church, which must be gathered together in unity. And let's end with this extract from Piero Bargellini's story of the Gospels. Whereas John uses the phrase, "he gave thanks," the other three evangelists write, "he said the blessing." And Bargellini explains.
This was a Hebrew prayer, usually recited by the father of the family. It was a beautiful prayer, which went like this. "Blessed be you, O Lord our God, who have sanctified us with your commandments, and who draw bread out of the earth." And as if it had really been drawn out of the earth, inexplicably but undeniably, the bread of the boy's 5 loaves multiplied miraculously in the hands of Jesus, until all the 5,000 men, women, and children had all eaten their fill on the green grass of the meadow.
Our thanks there once again to Chilbe Vilacqua for this inspirational programme. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, on a totally different note, it's time to join our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, as she speaks to us of Michelangelo's depiction of St. Paul in the Last Judgment fresco of the Sistine Chapel.
What we're doing at the moment, disentangling him.
Brida, you started before I did. We're talking about St. Paul, disentangling St. Paul, simply because there are a jumble of figures there on the wall of the Sistine Chapel.
Yes.
The Last Judgment fresco by Michelangelo, just next to the figure of Christ the Judge, together with the Madonna.
Between
there's
those.
Looking at it, to the right, there's St. Peter. Mm. And you say that behind St. Peter, there's St. Paul.
Mm. Well, actually, right next to him, except that he's sort of squashed in behind St. John the Evangelist, and sort of sometimes the figures are all mixed together here, so you see lots of arms and hands, etc., and you're trying to figure out, is this hand belonging to this figure or that person? So I think that happens to most people who look at the Last Judgment. You have to focus in a certain moment and just try and find the totality of a figure. So now we have Paul standing right beside St. Peter. Now, it's a smaller figure in a sense because he occupies also less space, and he's not shown in the totality of his figure, because here behind you can see a figure. He's generally shown, by the way, also in his iconographical attributes as an older man who's quite thin, wearing a long beard. Now,
and holding a sword.
Yes, yes.
There's no sword here.
No. But I mean, here Michelangelo tries always to be minimal in everything. He's minimalist. He puts what is absolutely necessary and nothing more. Because if you look up here, just above these figures, you have the angels who have no wings, who are carrying the attributes of the crucifixion. So he didn't bother to try and put wings in there just to complicate things. So the same thing happens down here. So straight down you have St. Paul. He seems to have a larger head than St. Peter, but you only get that effect because of the fact that he's put on him a very long grey beard. And both his hands are held up. Strange enough, his hands are held up in the same position that you would have imagined him to have his hands in this position if he was struck by a light when he was converted. So when he falls off his horse, he's lying on his back and his hands are up, and the hands are open towards God, this presence of God coming into his life. The figure is slightly tense. He's more tense than St. Peter, for example. St. Peter is more fluidly, completely in to what his role is already. Paul seems to be still sort of shaken by the position he finds himself in. So this is the early stage of his conversion, in a sense, too, if one thinks about it. These hands up, hands with a sense of awe, with a sense of shock, with a sense of wonder. He looks like he's stunned, to be quite frank. And Michelangelo has put on him a very beautiful red robe. And again, this red robe would also relate to his martyrdom. And because any time you see red on a martyr, you know that this is the colour of blood, the blood that's spilt for the martyrdom. So he's given him this particular kind of clothing. But also, technically speaking, he uses also this red to help divide the figures from each other as well. He's using that as a technical device, Michelangelo.
To disentangle the bodies.
Well, yeah, so it helps you to focus in on the figure of St. Paul without getting caught up too much. And then because you have his body is crisscrossed by the two hands of St. Peter with the two keys. So there's a lot of activity going on in that area there. So, again, everybody knows about the conversion of St. Paul. And then he became one of the apostles afterwards, obviously. He was a Jewish man from the tribe of Benjamin. He was also a Roman citizen. And he was a tent manufacturer. Now, it's interesting, this word, this concept of the tent, because sometimes the church itself has been compared to a tent, which gives, protection to the person.
The tent is a tabernacle, isn't it?
Yeah. This chapel is full of symbols. Now, it's a strange thing that in the 14 letters of St. Paul, he had the name of Jesus Christ pronounced 270 times, which is an amazing, amazing quantity of times. I mean, he was the first person to present what you might describe as a theological work, even though it was more of a spontaneous theological work rather than a researched work, because he spoke about the doctrine and ethics. Let's say he's the first theologian in a certain strange sense, you know? And so people tend to to compare sometimes Peter and Paul, but they're very, very different people, very, very different backgrounds, very, very different situations. But also in Jerusalem, Paul recognized the supremacy of Peter as the head of the apostles. So and this is also important. He was probably a different temperament also to St. Peter, probably a more proud person than St. Peter was. And you just get this feeling from what you read over the centuries, what's happened over the centuries and what people have written about these two figures. You always get the feeling that the figure of St. Paul is slightly more severe and the figure of Peter is severe, yes, but also paternal.
So and Michelangelo would have read up about
oh,
St.
yes,
Paul.
definitely, yes. And then, of course, the Pope's theologian in that period when Michelangelo was painting this would have given him any extra information that he needed. Now, Paul himself was imprisoned twice, and unfortunately the second time it was fatal for him because he was beheaded. And he was beheaded just on the outskirts of Rome, let's say on the Via Ostiense or Via Appia, on the way towards Ostia. And they say that when his head was severed from his body, that it bounced three times, and in this point the three fountains sprung up. But again, his remains are now buried in St. Paul's outside the walls, one of the patriarchal basilicas of the Vatican. And but again, it's nice to think also that here in Rome, we're talking here about many martyrs and saints. And it's a very nice feeling to think that the remains of a lot of these are here actually in Rome and quite near Rome. And so it makes the Sistine Chapel itself come alive in another sense. You tend to change your attitude towards the relics too. You tend to think of you focus on the relics as a little bit more than you would have maybe in the past, because we tend to just float through things in life sometimes, and or we're reading about the life of, but we don't focus on to the fact that maybe down the road there is a church with the relics of these saints. And this, in the case of St. Paul and St. Peter in particular, this is very important. And again, you think of people coming to the Sistine and coming to the Basilica of St. Peter to see the tomb of St. Peter. And again, you're thinking also on Peter, who is the Pope, in a sense, the first Pope. So there's this constant, wonderful recounting of epic dimensions, this Sistine Chapel.
A big thank you there to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently working at the American University of Rome. That's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed this programme. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.